Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
So I actually wrote 3 or 4 days a week from midnight to 3:30 in the morning if I didn't have a class to teach until the afternoon. And so there's a lot of action. And I found if you combine willingness to take action and the pictures you're making in your head, then sometimes really amazing things can happen.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. Sometimes when the spirit is soothed with a little extra care, the body returns to balance all by itself. It's something that I firmly believe in. And it's why today we're talking about why woo-woo works with Dr. David Hamilton, who's been on the podcast before. But as a reminder, he completed a PhD in organic chemistry, and David worked in research and development in the pharmaceutical industry, developing drugs for cardiovascular disease and cancer. And inspired by the placebo effect that we get into today, and how some people's conditions would improve because they believed a placebo was a real drug, David actually left the industry to write books and educate people on how they can harness their mind and emotions to improve their mental and physical health. Now, today, I want you to keep an open mind. We talk about crystals, energy biofields, visualization, the law of attraction, and a bunch of other concepts that make the skeptical part of my brain nervous to even consider talking about. But after reading the book, Why Woo Woo Works, The Surprising Science Behind Meditation, Reiki, Crystals, and Other Alternative Practices, it's really opened up my mind to the possibility of why these practices hold merit. Today, we talk about the mechanisms behind the placebo effect, positive and pessimistic consultations in general practice, something that I can definitely relate to, visualization and the immune system, nature, fractals, and responses to pain with plants. And then we also go into Reiki, biofield energy therapies, what that even means, and the emotional contagion via mirror neurons. This is going to be a really interesting podcast. If you're new to this, I do recommend the book. It's a fascinating read. It's full of references, full of interesting studies that, you know, might just change your mind. You can download the Doctor's Kitchen app, don't forget, for free via the App Store. We're working on an Android version right now. Every week, I send you a recipe, something to listen to, something to read, something to watch sometimes on my newsletter, Eat, Listen, Read. You can sign up at thedoctorskitchen.com. And remember, you can find all this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com on the podcast notes page. But for now, this is my conversation with Dr. David Hamilton. Please enjoy. Before we get started, here is a quick word from the people who make this podcast possible.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks so much for sending the book, first off. I'd love to get into this. I just love your writing style, and, you know, it's almost like you sort of tease us into the world of woo-woo, which we'll want to get to the definition of in a second. But you sort of tease us in. I think everyone can sort of understand meditation, mind over matter, all these different elements. And it gets like increasingly like more uncomfortable, I think, for the skeptical reader. And like my woo-woo detector is going beep, 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 like as soon as I go like throughout the book. But it's brilliant. It's absolutely fascinating. So why do we start off with woo-woo? What do we mean by woo-woo?
Woo-woo has been defined as unconventional beliefs regarded as having little or no scientific basis, especially those relating to spirituality, mysticism, and alternative medicine.
And so what you've been studying these different sort of modalities of healing for a while now. You know, we spoke about it on the pod last time, but what was your entry point into this sort of, I want to call it a way of thinking, a way of sort of having a nuanced appreciation of the science that we have available to us. What was your entry point into this?
To be honest, I had two entry points, one more scientific than the other. The first one for me was my mum had postnatal partum depression after my youngest sister was born in the mid-70s. And I remember finding a book at the library in the school when I just started high school. I'd never been in a library before. And, you know, I bumped a shelf or something and the book just, it fell off. It was The Magic Power of Your Mind by a gentleman called Walter Germain. And I remember thinking, I bet that can help my mum. And I didn't know you're supposed to join a library. You know, you get your little yellow card and stamp it. I thought you borrow books. So I'd never been in a library. So I just put it in my bag and took it away. We still have the book. I was 11 years old. But, you know, it didn't cure depression in a day. But you know what it did do, Rupi, is it gave my mum tools, insights and strategies that helped her to navigate a course through some of the difficult times, through those difficult days. One of the things my mum learned was positive affirmations. Another thing that she learned was meditation. Although back then, most people called it relaxation. Nowadays, we mostly refer to it as meditation or mindfulness, that style. But I remember it was so helpful to my mum, mostly for helping to calm her nerves, because my mum was struggling with depression and anxiety. And these things were immensely helpful. I remember my mum walking through the house sometimes when she was maybe feeling a bit kind of anxious and she was going, I can do it, I can do it. And she was pumping her fist and she would say to me, every day in every way, I'm getting better and better, which is my first introduction to the affirmations of Emmy Okui, but you created that one over 120 years ago. And so that was an entry point for me that was just through observation and experience. But you know, maybe 15 years or so, maybe 15 or so years later, after my PhD, I'm working in, you know, AstraZeneca, actually, and I'm helping develop drugs for cardiovascular disease and cancer. And it was observation of the placebo effect. It was looking at trial data and then going into the library and further researching it myself. And this was an entry point for me about the mind-body connection, because I remember I was so captivated by the placebo effect that, you know, patients, half the patients on a trial get the actual drug, half get a sugar pill. And I would ask my colleagues, and nobody understood the placebo effect. Then this was the late 90s. And even in a professional science environment, no one understood it. And if I said, you know, isn't that amazing? They would say, oh, they're not really getting better. They just think they're getting better. And it was just kind of dismissed. You're not in an unkind way, not in a, you know, people who believe in it are idiots kind of thing. It was just like nobody understood it. And it wasn't that the research wasn't available, because it was. But it just never occurred to anyone that there could be research, because who would, in a professional science environment, who would imagine that believing something could fiddle around with your brain chemistry? So I did exactly that. I went into the library and I started looking into it and discovering that research had already been done, showing that when you believe something, it's not just all in the mind. The belief itself actually, to an extent, fiddles around with your brain chemistry. So for example, a person who takes a placebo, believing it to be a painkiller, the belief itself or the expectation that the pain will go away triggers a change in the brain, causes the brain to produce its own painkillers, endogenous opiates, you know, the brain's natural version of morphine. And that substance then delivers the reduction in pain. So it's not an imaginary reduction in pain. It's a real reduction in pain produced by real substances in the brain, which are triggered by expectation or belief. And that was mind-blowing to me. And I was telling all my colleagues, and some of them, I think, tolerated me. You know, we were all friends. We drank pints in the bar. But no one really was interested in understanding it. It was just a wee quirk. You know, placebo effect was a nuisance. It wasn't something that you would be interested in developing and somehow using for the benefit of someone. In our professional environment, it was a nuisance. It was something, you know, how do we get rid of it kind of thing? Because you want to see how well a medicine is working. So it's really not something anyone had any interest in, except for me.
Yeah. And I think most people have come across at least the idea that the placebo or the placebo effect can be seen in pain, where you're given an inert substance or a substance that, you know, doesn't have an analgesic in it, and told that it is a powerful painkiller, and that elicits that literal response in the brain, which has the pain relieving effect. But where else do we see this placebo effect? Because I think what I certainly came across from the book is just the wide variety and application of elements that do have placebo, but as we'll discuss a little bit further, some other explanations behind. But where else do we see the placebo effect?
You know, most of the research has been done on pain, even Parkinson's disease, depression, anxiety, these sorts of things. In fact, some of the really amazing research on placebo on Parkinson's showed that over a period of 5 days, this was led by a professor, Fabrizio Benedetti, at the University of Turin, one of the top placebo researchers in the world. And they were able to actually phase out an anti-Parkinson's drug, apomorphine, over 5 days by dropping the dose while incrementally increasing placebo. And over 5 days, dropping apomorphine, increasing placebo, you know, 75%, 50, 25 apomorphine, 25, 50, 75% placebo, swapping them around. And after 5 days, getting a full placebo response from saline that you got from apomorphine. A lot of research has been done on Parkinson's, a lot of it in depression. I mean, there's limitations to the placebo effect. You wouldn't say, someone says, if you take this pill, you'll grow an extra arm. You know, it's, you know, there's limits to how we understand it, and there's limits to what the brain is capable of producing. But to an extent, there is a heck of a lot of breadth in there. There's a lot of conditions that the placebo effect impacts to an extent. You know, it's not necessarily a curative thing. It might not cure someone of arthritis, but there's a lot of research that shows that people who believe they actually had an incision, they actually had surgery for arthritis, but it was really called sham. It was a fake surgery. They go on to run and do everything as they would normally do. It didn't mean that the arthritis wasn't there, but somehow their brain and body was doing what it had to do to nullify the seeming symptoms of it. So I think there's so much in it that's yet to be tapped into and used that could be of really fantastic benefit to people.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that stood out for me in, you put so many studies in this book as well. It's fascinating. I've got like a long list of references that I need to check up on and read myself, because they're absolutely fascinating. One of them that stood out for me was the differences in consultation styles between general practitioners. And you have some who have a positive sort of way of discussing topics and treatments with their patients, and others who are sort of unsure or maybe a little bit on the pessimistic side, and the results of those and the outcomes actually being a lot more positive if they had a positive consultation style. So that certainly like speaks to me about what we should be teaching general practitioners, given that we see 20, 30, 40 patients every day. But I guess my question is sort of similar to what you just alluded to there with the impact of the placebo effect. Where is the line, and how far can we go when it comes to harnessing the placebo effect? And how do we use this almost in conjunction with all the other elements that we have within medicine as well? I mean, you just mentioned the sort of piece, PCDR, I think it's called, the placebo-controlled dose response, and how you can use
it. Yeah, placebo-controlled dose reduction.
Where is the line, and how do we actually... How do we go about determining where the line is?
Do you know, I actually don't think there's a solid line. I think there's a space, and it varies from condition to condition and from person to person, and it depends really on a number of factors. It depends on, as you've said, the consultation style, the personality of a doctor. It would depend also on the condition. Like, you could get a placebo effect from almost anything, really. That would impact a condition to an extent, maybe not the hard end of it, some severe conditions, but it might impact the softer end of it, you know, some of the actual symptoms that are manifesting. So rather than there being an actual line, there's probably a space in there that could well be tapped into for a number of different things, you know, and it's just some of it comes down to not just even the consultation style, but empathy. You know, a lot of research shows that, in fact, here's a study, 178 men with prostate cancer. And those who had been treated by what was called the high empathy doctor, and this is how the scientists, by studying their consultation style, they were able to determine who's a high empathy doctor and who's a low empathy doctor. And they found that even 3 months later, those treated with the high empathy doctor had far higher natural killer cells in the bloodstream. And it happened for a number of reasons. Partly, and this is all part of the, this can all be part of the placebo response. Part of it is a high empathy doctor is more reassuring. So what happens is the person comes away thinking, you know, I'm going to the doctor said, you know, if I do all these things, I should be okay. I've got this kind of thing, and they're reassuring me. So that belief itself actually causes physical effects in the body. But secondly, it encourages the patient to do more of what's good for them. The patient's more likely then to adopt a healthier diet and lifestyle because they've been reassured. So they're more likely to do things without realizing even that they're suddenly changing their diet. They have a wee bit more hope kind of thing. And so, plus empathy itself relaxes the nervous system. So treated by a high empathy doctor, then they come away, the nervous system's more relaxed because they've been reassured. And that then allows the body's natural regenerative systems, healing systems, to work more optimally, like the immune system, for example, pain management systems. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of parts to the placebo effect. It's not just that would fit within that. This is why I was meaning it's very broad. It's not a single line, because there's lots of different parts that fit into it. But certainly empathy and reassurance is very significant. And there's a lot of research that looks at the importance of empathy and how it can affect really the outcome for people.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that the empathetic approach is healing in itself. And I think this is almost why you have a lot of grounds for skeptics to be skeptical, because everything that we discuss in this sort of realm is, it just seems very messy, and it's not a very clear-cut way of testing these specific interventions. Like, placebo can also be visualization, affirmations, positive energy, the niceties of the consultation practice itself, even concepts that you go into later on in the book with regards to telepathy and, you know, positive energy that you're giving to the person in front of you, all these different elements that almost provide the entourage effect of all these different sort of like ways in which to deal with patients. So this is why I think it's quite hard when you compare it to the kind of trials that you've been involved in the early part of your career, when you give one substance and you test it in a randomized controlled manner, and you put that against something else that you know not to have the same analog or compound in. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think of when I was trained in, you know, in pharmaceutical sciences, I guess, if you think of it broadly in that way, what's ingrained in us, you know, when, in fact, my first introduction to that was before I did my PhD, my degree specialized in biological and medicinal chemistry. And that was when I first heard the concept of an active ingredient. And when you're an organic chemist, which ultimately is where I was trained in, the goal is to build a physical substance, a drug. And that involves assembling atoms in a particular way into a very unique shape that's been figured out in one way or another, that this is what does it. And this is called the active ingredient. It's ingrained in us that when a person takes a medicine, the only thing that matters is the active ingredient. So in a paracetamol, there's paracetamol is the active ingredient, but there's half a dozen other things there as well. Otherwise, because you've only got a tiny amount of paracetamol, the rest of it is stuff that bulks it up, helps it to dissolve differently. And so, you know, there's a range of things called excipients. But it was ingrained in us, there's a single active ingredient. But when you start looking into the broader placebo effect and empathy, the mind-body connection, all these things, you realize there's actually a lot of active ingredients and all of them contribute. And not just in a, you know, we sometimes think of, you know, the importance of empathy and even the environment. We sometimes think of it in a, as part of a holistic thing and not in a doctor's surgery, but it matters in a doctor's surgery as well. We just didn't realize to what extent it matters. We're now realizing that empathy, for example, is huge. It does actually matter quite a lot. So there's a lot of active ingredients. And I would say it becomes then more tricky, especially if you're not testing a drug. If you're looking at the benefits of, let's say, an alternative practice, then more of these active ingredients are present in the alternative practice because they don't have the acute effect of a drug, because the drug effect itself is acute. But you've got other active ingredients like empathy, setting, even whether the environment, that the room has plants in it. I mean, research shows, for example, you put two identical rooms, hospital or clinical rooms, and give and subject people as part of a study to pain, right? Just a simple pain test. Pain thresholds are higher and recovery faster if the identical rooms, one has plants in it. And isn't that amazing? And that's because plants, green nature itself is recognized by humans over, it's ingrained over eons to cause a calming effect. But that's an active ingredient as well. But these subtler active ingredients become more important when you have a therapy that lasts longer than a 10-minute consultation. And so it becomes more difficult to measure just the impact of one acute substance versus nothing at all. And now you've got to, it is tricky to build it all. And so what you have to do is say, let's take all of this together, combined with a therapy, and see if it helps someone, rather than just measuring the impact of an individual little thing. All of these things are helpful, so let's use all of them.
Yeah. Actually, now you mention the plants in hospital rooms, I did want to talk about that because I love this sort of the concept of how we have a natural affinity to fractals. And there are some really interesting studies that you talked about in the book where, you know, people who had the same intervention, i.e. a cholecystectomy, a removal of the gallbladder, for example, some had a brick wall to look at, and then some people had a park to look at, and they measured their responses to pain afterwards, and they found the park viewers had a better pain response. And you talk about fractals in the environment and how, you know, we've developed over eons to sort of have that sort of that the affinity to them. I wonder if you could go into that a bit more, because I found that element absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, me too. In fact, you know, I stumbled upon that accidentally. You know, my partner is doing an Open University degree in philosophy and psychology, and it was one of her modules I had to study, that an entire textbook on the effect of nature, and I couldn't believe it. I'd never come across this. And really what happens is, for eons of evolution, for eons, our ancient ancestors lived in, you know, natural settings. You know, in fact, we emerged out of what is now Botswana. So for eons, our ancestors lived in areas that are green, you know, green grass, green trees, with the sound of birdsong and the sound of crickets and stuff at nighttime, with blue sky. And so what happened is, if you compare the general stress levels of us in modern humans to them, you'll find that they were pretty much chilled out most of the time. Yeah, we sometimes think, oh, what a hostile environment they lived in. From time to time, they're not being threatened with saber-toothed tigers every day. You know, for the most part, our ancient ancestors sat about twiddling their thumbs, pretty much just sleeping and not doing very much. Their nervous system is very relaxed, very chilled. The modern humans, we're highly strung all the time because you're thinking, you know, I finished this podcast, what, I need to go to Tesco and I need to get this, and oh God, I forgot that email yesterday. And most humans are on edge all the time. The nervous system's spiked all the time. So, but for our ancestors, for eons, they're pretty chilled out. And what happened is a connection, a correlation began to form over a long time between the state of the nervous system and the perception of the environment at that time. So what our ancestors were experiencing in the environment, what was connected to this calm nervous system. So over eons, that correlation occurred. And so nowadays, for us modern humans, the moment you see a green space, you know, blue sky, trees, grass, the tweeting of birds, even the noise of crickets at nighttime, that ancient effect kicks in and the human nervous system tends toward relaxation. And the longer you're in nature, the more we begin to relax. And that's what gave birth to some of these scientific studies, even some of them that stimulate the nervous system and measure exactly how long it takes to calm. And if people can even see a green space or even listen to birdsong, the nervous system recovers faster. And that's why some studies find that hospital patients recover faster if their window offers them a view of nature rather than a brick wall or a hospital car park, for example. It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely incredible. And, you know, I think about this through the lens of cost-effective interventions that may have a significant impact, you know, whether it's someone in hospital or someone who's trying to help themselves in the community environment. And you have this line in the book that I had to write down. It's called, it goes, humans have become like tuning forks that vibrate sweetly to the sounds of nature. That resonated with me so much because every day I've got a little dog and I have to take her outside and stuff. And I've tried to reduce the use of my AirPods just so I can listen to the swaying of the trees and you know, the sights, and actually put more of my attention into the natural surroundings that I'm very privileged to have quite close to me. And that just sort of brought it all home for me, and learning a bit about how we've been attuned and we've evolved alongside nature just put everything into context. So yeah, no, I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and actually what you said a moment ago about fractal, I've got a wee dog as well, and I live in Dunblane, central Scotland, and there's lots of green space. It's actually a green belt where I live, so it's absolutely brilliant for that. But you know what you said about fractals, it reminded me when you say you look at the trees and stuff, the human nervous system even can spot the difference between real and fake, and that's where fractals come in, because some scientists investigating, you know, why is this that we are attuned to nature? And it's because most of nature is fractal, you know, like trees. You know, a tree grows like that and then it branches off, and then the branches branch off, and then those branches branch off. And it's like the growth rules say, okay, the tree's got a wee rule somewhere in its genes that say, okay, now we need to branch. And the wee rule runs again and it branches again. And so most of nature is fractal. And so our brains and nervous systems have become attuned, if you will, to recognizing something natural by its fractal component. And that's why if you give something that's real versus something that's a fake version, the human nervous system reacts better to something that's real, because our brains actually recognize the fractal component, which is something inherent to nature itself, isn't that? That blows me away, actually.
That really does blow me away. And it kind of explains some other studies that I've come across. I'm not too sure if you mentioned this in your book or not, or maybe it's another one, but if people are exposed to urbanized environments, either in a video or they watch something and then they do a test that tests their cognitive ability, those are significantly hindered compared to if they were exposed to green environments or natural environments. And I remember looking at it, I was like, wow, that's incredible. It just means that the cogs in our brain are just sort of oiled by looking at natural environments. And you know, it just enhances everything else, whether it be our ability to cope with pain or ability to think clearly, all those different elements. So yeah, nature is certainly a drug.
Certainly, I mentioned that study along with even studies that were looking at the crime rates in areas, and they put in some trees into an area. And just because the trees themselves and the bushes and the flowers had a calming effect, it was incredible that there was the crime rate was lower. But another study similar, all part of that same chapter actually, scientists got people to do a walk round a historic city in the Czech Republic, and they timed them, and they were listening to bird. One group was listening to bird songs, one was listening to urban sounds like traffic and all that kind of stuff, and they found that those who were listening to traffic sounds walked significantly faster and completed a 1 kilometer circuit through the city much faster than those who were listening to bird song, who actually found themselves, the whole body was just slowing down and relaxing. And the only difference, they walked the exact same route around this historic city. The only difference was what did they hear in their mind, in their heads, was urban environment or birdsong. And I thought, amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Ever since I came across that research, when I'm working, I actually have on my phone natural sound playing. Yeah. And I wrote half of this book while listening to natural sounds.
That's brilliant. When I read that in the book, I told my partner straight away, because we have this like ongoing argument about how I walk really, really slow whenever in the park. And she's like walking, you know, at least like 5 miles more than me, like up ahead of me when we're walking the dog. And she's like, you walk like a pensioner. You walk so slow. And like, sweetie, I'm just like really attuned to the environment. This study shows when they walk people around this historic environment, they were just like just really taking everything in. So you just need to take in more of the nature. This is on you. It's not on me.
Nice one.
I wanted to talk about one of the other studies that you mentioned here from close to home, Lincolnshire NHS Hospital, and the visualization techniques they taught patients who were undergoing chemotherapy, imagining things like the macrophages, some of the immune cells as part of our immune system, gobbling up cancer cells and increasing their immune response. And that was actually measured to have a significant response. And they did some other sort of visualization techniques that were pretty incredible. So like what's going on there?
Yeah. So in that particular study, it was women who had breast cancer, and they were all going through, you know, the same treatment. So surgery, radiotherapy, chemotherapy. And so they all had exactly the same treatment. But half of them, in addition to that treatment, not instead of, but in addition to, they were also taught visualization practices where, as I say, they imagine, you know, macrophages gobbling up things. Or many of them visualized the immune cells as piranha fish or Pac-Man destroying cancer cells. But for each person, in their own way, visualized the immune system destroying the cancer cells. And what you found is their immune system was heightened. In one study, their immune system was significantly heightened. In other studies, there was a real positive effect. And what happens is, in some ways, when you imagine something, there's a fine line between real and imaginary as far as your brain's concerned. And lots of research is now weighing into this and saying, in many ways, your brain doesn't distinguish all that much between real and imaginary. So when you imagine something or do it, to your brain, it's very similar. And I think in the last podcast, I gave an example of a seminal Harvard research study where volunteers played piano notes each day for 5 days, and another set of volunteers imagined playing the same notes each day for 5 days, and the changes in the brain were identical. And you couldn't tell the difference. And now other research has done something similar, and they've got people to eat cubes of cheese or imagine eating cubes of cheese, and the overall impact on appetite was exactly the same. In other words, even imagining eating, providing you imagine eating, you know, bite for bite, chew for chew for the same duration, was actually having the same impact on the brain to an extent as actually eating itself. In other studies, there's several studies, even like people get physically stronger by imagining working out at the gym. And even people who have injuries, one study even had people who weren't injured, but they were immobilized with a plaster cast for a month. And the scientists measured the reduction in strength. And most people lost, you know, 45% strength. But half of them, in addition to having the plaster cast, they were to imagine pushing their hand against the cast. So imagine and strengthen the wrist. They only lost 23% strength. They lost half the strength. And all they did was visualize. And so, but what this study did is show maybe the same principles apply to the immune system. When you're visualizing the immune system doing something, then it seems to be that in some way the immune system is responding to what you're imagining and beginning to work in the way according to what you're actually imagining. And it's astonishing because other research shows the immune system is actually quite sensitive to how you feel. And it's also quite sensitive to psychological states, but it's also sensitive to relaxation, sensitive now, we know, to imagery. So that study was born out of a conglomeration of all of these observations. And someone, a hospital, thought, let's see then. There is previous research showing that visualizing secretory immunoglobulin A, or SIGA, it's a double Y-shaped antibody. You know, antibodies kind of Y-shaped. It's a double Y-shaped. And it's the first part of your immune system that responds if you, say, drop a piece of food and you pick it up, it's contaminated. SIGA is the first part of the immune system that responds to that. And people visualizing, multiplying it, were actually able to increase the amount of SIGA in their saliva compared to people just doing a relaxation technique. So all of these studies together weighed into that, and scientists thought, let's see then, that there seems to be evidence that visualizing the immune system can impact it. So let's test it with people who've got cancer, but make sure everyone's getting treatment, not instead of. And I make that point really strong because sometimes people who are skeptical of these kind of things assume that what you're saying is visualize instead of medicine, but never saying that. We're always saying do whatever intervention is necessary, but visualize as well. Because you know, you don't meditate instead of sleeping. You sleep and you meditate. You know, you don't go out for a run and stuff instead of eating. You know, you do all of these good things together. So what I'm suggesting, and I've made that point all the way through the book, really, is, you know, alternative practices aren't instead of doing mainstream practices. They're stuff that we can do in addition to them to get an overall, maybe an enhanced effect. And this visualization study was a very clear demonstration. The immune response to cancer was far higher in those who visualized versus those who just had the treatment itself.
Yeah, yeah. It marries quite nicely with actually a topic that you bring up a lot later on in the book, The Law of Attraction, which, I mean, I've been fascinated with. Obviously, I've read The Secret. I've spoken to Tara Swart on the podcast here about manifestation. And you have some interesting insights into the law of attraction. It's not just visualizing it blankly. It's also where you're focusing your attention and also combined with actions. You use the example of David Beckham, for example, or I think it was Sally Gunner earlier on in the book as well, you know, who visualized the winning, the sort of the actions that have taken there and combined with the action. I wonder if you could talk to me a bit about the law of attraction and how you advise people utilize this tool, because I'm personally fascinated with it. And I'll give you an example of like how I'm putting it into practice myself.
Yeah, I find it fascinating as well. And what I always say is sometimes when people think of what is generally called the law of attraction, you assume that I just have to close my eyes and meditate on picturing something and it will just materialize out of thin air and land in my lap. And that is cannon fodder for people who are skeptical. You know, and what I often say is you can combine mindset and what you're visualizing with taking physical action. I one thing I wrote in the book, I remember when I got I had a few books published, and I remember one of my friends said to me, look how you manifested that. You know, you had a goal to get a book published and wow, look at you now. But what they didn't see was the blood, sweat and tears of actions. You know, I wrote most of that book in the middle of the night because I was teaching. I was a chemistry lecturer, which a job that I did for a year, not long after I left the pharmaceutical industry. And so the only time I could find was the middle of the night. So I actually wrote 3 or 4 days a week from midnight to 3:30 in the morning if I didn't have a class to teach until the afternoon. And so there's a lot of action And I found if you combine willingness to take action and the pictures you're making in your head, then sometimes really amazing things can happen. But one of the points I did make about the law of attraction is that some research has looked at is consciousness produced by the brain, or is the brain in the entire world an experience of consciousness? And there is a growing body of evidence to suggest it's the latter, despite how much our ingrained assumptions are it's the former. And some research found that by studying people who had frontal lobe damage in the brain, which created an automatic sense of what's called absorption. In other words, they feel with particular frontal lobe damage, and this study was done by a neurologist, particular frontal lobe damage, it makes them feel absorbed, at one with nature, with whatever, whether they're even looking at a computer screen. They actually feel somehow, you and I look at a computer screen and it's clearly detached from you. But to them, people with particular frontal lobe damage, the line between you and reality is ever so blurred, and there's a feeling of connectedness with everything. And they found that those people could actually subtly influence physical states in the world. I mean, I'm not talking they've just imagined something and someone's going to levitate up off the ground. Nothing like that, but very, very subtle things they could cause impact in their immediate physical environment. Again, I'm not talking about levitating pens rolling across tables like you see in the movies, but very, very subtle things. If you know what to look for, what to test for, very, very subtle things. And it occurred predominantly with people with particular frontal lobe damage, because previous research had suggested that if, as well as visualizing an action, you actually can try to feel as if it's really there, bring all of your sensory, your sensory modalities, and feel like what you're imagining to be true really is true, and put yourself in it so that you emotionally feel it, then lots of books like The Secret and other books have been written suggesting that ingredient matters quite a lot. So when I was researching through the book on other subjects, actually, prayer, ESP, telepathy, that kind of stuff, that seemed to be a very important ingredient, was felt connection with things. And I think the frontal lobe damage study was a pivotal study. It's something that stands as a bridge that begins to say, oh, I can actually see now how these kind of things work, because here's a really solid piece of research done by a neurologist who was skeptical of this kind of stuff, demonstrating, say, predicting that, well, if it's true that feeling connected with something should have is an ingredient for this, then let's pick people who that is already a given. They have frontal lobe damage, so they already feel connected. And let's see if we can take them with other people and see anything that's different in how they affect their environment. And there was a very clear difference in that study.
On the subject of connection, I definitely want to go into that a bit more. I totally agree with you about the subject of manifestation, and then like speaking to people and them not really seeing the sort of behind the scenes. When I wrote my first book, I was working full time as a general practitioner and locuming at the weekends. And the only time I could actually write my cookbook and test the recipes and do all the research was outside of working hours. So I'd be working until like 10, 11 p.m., and then getting up the next day and trundling off to general practice. I mean, it's tons of work, but like, I did hold this sort of idea and a sort of vague visual of like what it could be and where it eventually went. So whether you call that manifestation or the law of attraction, I'm not too sure. But one thing actually that stood out to me in that chapter was a quote, I think you put in from another researcher about how the commonest misuse of perception is a focus on what you do not have. And I actually find myself doing that sometimes, because at this point of the recording, my app launched in January. I have an agency that do all the tech team and all the technical stuff, which I direct. And what I'm missing
is an internal tech team, an internal chief of technology, an internal UX designer. And my focus has actually been, and this really did resonate with me, my focus is actually on what I do not have rather than what I do have right now and actually what I want to achieve. And actually just reading those words have now sort of shifted my focus on what I want to visualize and what I want to pay attention to. So I think it's certainly super important.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think when you start to think about the law of attraction, I mean, despite disagreements between some camps and other camps as to how it works, if you let's sidestep how it works and just presuppose that when you visualize something, sometimes seemingly strange things can occur that somehow you meet that experience in your life, regardless of how it comes around. But somehow, the more you visualize something, the more likely you are to meet that in your experience. So therefore, if that's the case, if we are giving our attention annoyingly to the stuff that we don't have, so I'm really, you know, I really want a new car. I'm really hacked off at this car that I've got there. It's always breaking down. And then all the attention is on what you don't want. Then if that is actually something that reflects life itself, then that's what you're going to get more of. Because what this law of attraction seems to say is you get more of what you give most of your attention to. So therefore, it's a no-brainer, really, then. Let's give more attention to the stuff that you really think would be lovely to have in your life rather than the stuff that really kind of pisses you off.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk a bit about some of the subjects that I think are, well, I want to say the word brave, but I guess, you know, you're looking at this from a scientific lens and you're looking at the weight of evidence, you know, using your years of training. And for you, I think it's the impression I get from reading the book and listening to your words are that, you know, this is sort of stuff that should be more mainstream. It should be more accepted because we do have enough research to suggest that these things exist, and we should be utilizing them, you know, in a personal capacity, but also within healthcare as well. Well, let's start with Reiki. I can't remember if I told you the story, but one of my consultants when I was working in pediatrics in Brighton many years ago now, it's probably about 7 or 8 years ago, he actually had a Reiki practitioner come in for the parents and the parents of the children that they were treating. And it wasn't, you know, in a medical ward, it was actually in pediatric ICU as well. And it was really well embraced actually by parents, but he was a really firm believer in Reiki as a mode of practice. So where does, for those of us who haven't come across Reiki before, where does Reiki come from? And maybe we can go into why it's so dismissed and what sort of evidence there is to the contrary.
It was founded by a guy called Mikio Yusui, you know, 100 years or so ago, you know, and he felt inspired during like a fast, a meditative retreat, to find a way to offer something freely to people that could benefit them. And he had the idea, I think, based on, you know, thousands of years of knowing what had gone on in the ancient worlds and stuff. And he came up with this concept of Reiki, where he would just really put his hands on or just above people. And he started giving it freely to people. And it was having really, really profound effects. And it's just gathered momentum over the years until it's beginning to become really properly scientifically tested. And this is why you're finding it coming into hospitals. A similar one, I remember, came across some research at a study at Bryn Mawr Hospital, a large hospital in Pennsylvania, and they were approached to be part of a Reiki study for people who had total knee replacements, which is one of the most common operations in the United States. And initially, they were very skeptical about allowing a Reiki study in a professional environment, like professional clinical environment, but they eventually allowed it to take place. And basically, everyone went through the same treatment, but half of the patients additionally received Reiki. And the reduction in pain in those who had Reiki, as well as everything else, the only difference was Reiki everything else plus Reiki versus everything else. And the reductions in pain of those who had Reiki were so significant, the hospital were completely convinced. They actually started their own Reiki program and trained 10 of their own nurses to now, to this day, now offer Reiki to any patients who elect to have it as given as an option. Would you like to receive Reiki as well? Not instead of, but as well as. Oh, pardon me. And I thought that was a great example, a practical example. But now randomized controlled trials have been done on Reiki. Reiki compared with placebo. And your placebo is, in, you can't, you know, it's not a tablet or anything. So it's called mimic Reiki. And what mimic Reiki is where an actor, a professional actor, has watched a video of a Reiki master and spent time mirroring their movements and saying, okay, the Reiki master puts her hands there, and then they do it for, like, say, 30 seconds. So what the actor is going, put the hand in, they go 1, 2, 3, and they're counting in their heads. And then they say the Reiki master takes 2 steps to the left, so they do the same thing. And what even randomized controlled trials show is, even comparing against mimic Reiki, i.e. placebo, Reiki has been highly effective for reducing pain, improving symptoms of anxiety and depression, and improving quality of life across a range of different conditions, including things like cancer. You know, so there is some really strong, even statistical evidence emerging nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, it's super interesting. And, you know, you describe it as a type of biofield energy therapy, which is generally dismissed. I mean, even sort of broaching the topic, I think, is uncomfortable for a lot of people. I mean, how do you go about dealing with skeptics? I mean, there's a couple of studies there that you've just talked about, but how do we sort of shake off that perception of how this is all sort of, to use your word, woo-woo, and you know, sort of start embracing these different therapies? Because it is for a conventionally trained medic, it is quite difficult to have these conversations in the sort of cloud of judgment of your peers.
Yeah, for me, first of all, empathy combined with science, because you find people are skeptical. They're not skeptical because they try to be nasty. They're skeptical because some doctors, for example, are skeptical because they're worried that someone who has pain, the pain might be masking something more serious, and they might go to a Reiki practitioner instead of seeing a doctor. And so there's an inbuilt skepticism that isn't being unkind. It's saying we really need to know for sure. We need to see the evidence. So first of all, for me, it's empathy and understanding that you have a valid concern. And so I'm not just going to, you know, say all this stuff without taking into account your concern. But when I bring science in, one of the first things I find I have to introduce is the term biofield, because it's, you know, I wouldn't bother using that term if it wasn't for the fact that Reiki is classified as a biofield therapy. So because it's classified, I find that requires an explanation. And, you know, a biofield is just a field of energy like electricity or magnetism that's generated by a biological process rather than a wall socket. And it's funny because, you know, I love to learn. So I've been studying for 5 years with the Open University in the UK for a degree in mathematics and physics, because I just love to continue to learn. And I actually learned that term as part of my physics modules, one of a biofield. And it's just a distinction between, you plug your iPhone into the wall, and we call that electricity, but it's actually an electric field, which generates a magnetic field. Electricity and magnetism go hand in hand. But if that electric or magnetic field is generated by a biological process, for example, the movement of sodium or calcium or potassium or something in and out of cells, then that's called a biofield. To make that distinction between the source of the field. So I find sometimes when I bring that up, it begins to make more sense. It doesn't, the term biofield loses its woo-woo title, because it is an actual physical distinction, as you have to make a distinction, what is the source of the field. And a good way to think about biofield therapies is, let's say I have a plate of food and I want to heat that food up, then I would put that food in a warm environment. So the what I'm doing is I'm changing the temperature field. And that's, again, that's a real physics concept. That's the space around the substance, the food here, that has a temperature measurement. So it's called the temperature field, and it changes depending on the environment. And so if I change the temperature field, then that changes the temperature of the food inside it. So there's always a correlation between the food itself, what's inside the food, and the temperature field on the outside. If I wanted to cool the food down, I put it in a cold temperature field. And so there's always a correlation. So the idea behind biofuel therapies is there's a correlation between the state of the body and the electric or magnetic field that's generated by the body. So for example, when you feel, here's something we know quite well from science, when you feel love, affection, empathy, warmth, compassion, the heart's magnetic field is larger and more easier to measure. It's stronger than it is if you feel anxious or stressed or angry. And so there's a clear difference. And we know that in science as well, because if you feel love or warmth or affection, blood flow through the heart and into your muscles is very different from if you feel anxious or stressed or angry. So all the heart's magnetic field is showing you is, yes, there is a correlation between the biofield. And so the underlying belief in scientists as to how a biofuel therapy works is a somehow an interaction between the healer themselves, their biofield, and the biofield of the person who's on the table. And to an extent that might be helping to change some of the more subtle systems in the body. And when I say subtle, the research in Reiki seems to suggest that there's a calming of the nervous system in people who are receiving Reiki. And if the nervous system is calmed rather than stressed or alert, then the body's pain management systems work more optimally. The immune system works more optimally. So the body's healing systems work more optimally. And I think that's why biofuel therapies are classified in that way. And they're not saying a Reiki practitioner heals a patient, but somehow interacts with a patient that allows the patient's own systems to do the work by themselves. And that's why Reiki doesn't cure serious diseases, but it certainly calms the body and allows the body to do what the body's capable of doing to an extent. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense to me, because it reminds me of a conversation I had with Dr. Deepak Ravindran, who's a pain consultant. And I think pain has been misunderstood by many pain consultants and many anesthetists for decades. And now there's a new accepted understanding of how pain is the reception of certain chemicals, and actually the perception of pain is very much in the brain. And so that makes it malleable to things like cognitive behavioral therapy, in addition to pain analgesics, etc. And this kind of reminds me of that, because what you're describing, and I think the key word here is correlation. So there's definitely a correlation between this practice and an enhanced outcome or a particular outcome. And you can explain, like, you know, the temperature field through the physical mechanisms, or let's say love. I think that's a really good sort of analogy there. Love, if you look at it from a physical concrete lens, my blood pressure increases, my heart rate increases, there's vasodilation of my fingertips, you know, I have a warm feeling inside. But you can't describe or you can't explain love through the physical mechanisms that are elicited when you're in love. Love is like it's an energy, it's a transfer. There's, you know, it's cognitive, it's environmental. There's a whole bunch of other things going on that we can't fully explain through the means of our current scientific methodology. So I agree. I think there's definitely something there. There is a correlation. In my mind, I'm still trying to figure out, I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out exactly what is going on. But it's definitely something that, you know, if it's in combination with and something that is generally positive and not in replacement of, then it's something that we should embrace.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you know, in my scientific opinion, I think we don't fully understand the how as to how Reiki works. You know, I made attempts at two possibilities as explanations in the book, but you know, I don't think enough science has been done on the how. You know, so when I'm talking, you know, I was trying to explain why is there a difference between a Reiki master and someone who's just mimicking the movements. And you got it there with love, because when you train in Reiki or any holistic therapy, part of the training is empathy, is to be in service for the person. Now, we do know that when you that changes, if you're feeling love, empathy, compassion for someone, and you're the person's on that couch, that massage table, if that's how people do the Reiki, then your predominant feeling there is love, it's empathy, it's compassion. And we do know that that changes blood flow, and that changes not only how you feel, but there's a physical effect of that, but there's also a electromagnetic effect, because you can't separate the physical process from the biofield. You just cannot separate. There is, whether that sounds woo-woo or we agree with it or not, you cannot separate the two. And so my attempt at an explanation was the reason why there's a difference between a Reiki master and an actor doing exactly the same thing is empathy, the love and the compassion. And I'm just suggesting that probably, and I might be wrong, but probably there's an interaction between the Reiki master with the biofield of the person who's on the table that's somehow causing a calming effect on that person, which is therefore allowing their own systems to work a little bit more optimally. You know, and it's not a scientific definite, because I don't think science has got as far as understanding the how. It's more just this seems to be what we observed from studies on it, but we don't really know how.
This is a really good point, because it kind of brings me to another element of the book where you draw an analogy between birds of flight using the Earth's magnetic field to direct travel, something that I don't think was well understood prior by physicists. And now there is a general understanding about how they are attuned to the magnetic fields around the globe. I wonder if we could talk a bit about that, because it sort of lends itself to a conversation around crystals, which are, you know, if anyone's got a woo-woo detector, it's going off the chain right now, you know. So so and I you know I just to be sort of as honest as possible, my understanding of crystals is minimal, and I've always thought of it as something like, you know, holds no sort of bearing in science. But my family, you know, particularly coming from an Indian background where we have a lot of Ayurvedic traditions, you know, there are lots of things that we do and the explanations that we have for them that wouldn't be classed as scientific, but I embrace. So, you know, whether it's crystals, whether it's empathy, whether it's a belief in certain fields, you know, I'm really open-minded about it. But I'd love to hear your take on that, because I had Jim Al-Khalili on the podcast, Professor Jim Al-Khalili on the podcast. He's an esteemed physician. He does the life sciences on Radio 4. His book actually talks about birds of flight using the Earth's magnetic field to direct travel. So I find this absolutely fascinating, and I wonder if there are some similarities within our own bodies.
There is actually, and it's a very good example of something that used to be called woo-woo and you know, really dismissed as nonsense. Even people, brave scientists investigating it, were kind of mocked and laughed at, you know, ridiculous idea.
Yeah.
And it's now what I call true woo. And I make that distinction. A lot of things that we call woo-woo are actually true woo. They're actually... I made up that term, true woo, meaning there is actually science available, but people who call it woo woo just don't know that science is available. And so I make that kind of distinction. This is one of them. And it's actually called the avian magnetic compass. Now, the reason for it is in the brain of birds and humans as well, we have a mineral called magnetite, which contains iron. But birds also have a pigment in their retinas called cryptochrome. And what the combination of magnetite and humans don't have cryptochrome, but we have magnetite. And what the magnetite and the cryptochrome do, the magnetite, first of all, makes birds subtly aware of the Earth's magnetic field, because the Earth's magnetic field runs, you know, right where you're sitting right now, it runs completely flat along the ground, completely horizontal. It starts at the North Pole and it comes out the top of the Earth and it goes round like that. So wherever you're standing, it's completely flat, right? But the further north or south you go, the angle dips depending on how far north you are or south you are. There's an inclination, a dip angle, depending, and that's how. And so what cryptochrome does is it gives the birds a color representation of the lines of the magnetic field. You can't see them, but even the human brain, recent research at Caltech actually found the human brain detects shifts to the orientation of the magnetic field. They put humans inside magnetically sealed chambers, simulated the Earth's magnetic field, and then shifted the orientation. And every single person's brain reacted to it, even though consciously we weren't aware, but the human brain absolutely instantly detected the shift in the angle of it. But anyway, so we're sensitive as well. It's just not something we use because we predominantly rely on eyesight and sound and stuff. But anyway, birds sense the Earth's magnetic field, but cryptochrome allows them to see it. And scientists now believe birds see the lines of the Earth's magnetic field and the dip angle of it that tells them how far north or south they are, like we would see a road. And to really prove that concept, scientists created this massive big, and they put them in this massive big aircraft hangar, and they electromagnetically shielded it, and they simulated the Earth's magnetic field, and the birds were flying according to it. And then the scientists rotated it. They rotated the angle of it, and all of a sudden the birds just went, and they changed instantly. The whole lot of them, as if the road had just turned that way. And so now we know factually, you know, as woo as it sounds, it's actually true, woo, that the avian magnetic compass is actually how birds fly south for the winter and end up back not only in the same town, but on the same branch of the same tree in the same garden that they left all those months ago. And the reason why they get back there, a large part of the reason, isn't just visually looking at the environment, but actually following the Earth's magnetic field. You know, some whales and dolphins do it as well, and some fish also follow the Earth's magnetic field. They use the currents of it and the movements of it, just like you and I have learned over time to walk, to follow a path. And why would you walk off into the grass when there's a path there? So birds over eons, without having paths that humans have built, they've just learned to use the natural environment itself. And part of that is the avian magnetic compass.
Yeah, it's incredible that. And so are there similarities within our brains? Do we have magnetite or certain other elements in our brains that we've discovered?
Yeah, absolutely. We have magnetite in the human brain. In fact, MRI scans recently mapped it and found it's very extensive, with heightened concentrations in the pineal gland, but it's very extensive in the human brain. And that research was connected to or an extension of the Caltech research that showed that we are magnetically sensitive to a change in the Earth's magnetic field. And so scientists decided to see if we can map it, the magnetite, using MRI, and absolutely found concentrations all the way, all throughout the brain. So we are magnetically sensitive. But the people who did some of that research wrote that we've just learned to not use it because we use our other senses. But it's not that we can't. It's there, but it's not a predominant thing for us. We drive our cars and use road signs. Mm. You know, we don't walk along and go, I feel that's north, you know, whereas a bird does.
Yeah.
Because birds don't have cars and road signs. So we've just learned over X amount of time, and I don't know how long, but we've learned to use different ways to navigate, but that system is still there. We just don't use it.
Yeah. It's kind of like me adopting Google Maps, so much so that I probably wouldn't be able to direct myself around London now. I've sort of like, you know, just completely handed over my compass skills to the app on my phone. And you know, this sort of speaks to the lack of practice around intuition. Like I always talk about, you know, mindfully eating, making sure that you're aware of every single bite and you're chewing properly and you're not distracted, and how this can have benefits in terms of your digestive
process and reducing bloating and all that kind of stuff. But I feel that we need to be a lot more intuitive just in general, because we have a lot of artificial environments around us. And so it's one of those practices that we should definitely be leaning into. And on that note of perception, one of the things that I was absolutely fascinated to hear about was how my dog has a completely different visual system, in that she doesn't see as many colors as me, or she sees things that I see green as like beige or brown or whatever it might be. And there are other animals, there are other beings that have heightened vision and can see even more colors. So I wonder if you could talk to us a bit about that and how that might sort of conjure up ideas of like whether we can see auras and energy fields and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So humans are called trichromats, and that means three colors. We have three types of photoreceptors or cones in our eyes that allow us to see the range of colors that we see. You know, so the RGB, that reflects the cone, the photoreceptors we have. But dogs only have two. Dogs are called dichromats. And if a dog looks at grass, like you say, it looks beige to a dog, and a dog sees a rainbow, it's kind of grey, dark blue, light blue, beige, into a wee bit deeper shade of beigey brown. And a dog has never seen a rainbow that we see. So the question is, you know, who sees correctly? And the answer is nobody sees correctly, because nobody actually sees reality as it is. All we see is a representation of reality that's dependent upon our perceptual process, our perceptual abilities. So some species, like foraging insects, for example, they have four, some of them have five and six cones or photoreceptors, meaning they see an alien landscape that is completely invisible. In fact, many of those species see ultraviolet and right into the ultraviolet. In other words, when you look at a flower, you just see the outline of the flower, but they see ultraviolet plumes that are even related to how the Earth's magnetic field is interacting, because there's a thing called, again, it used to be considered woo-woo, but it's true, plant magnetoreception. You know, plants are very... And the reason why scientists are studying the sensitivity of plants to the Earth's magnetic field is because everyone knows we're looking at, maybe in 50 years, could we put a colony on the moon or in Mars? Now, despite differences in soil, you have differences in magnetic field. So it's called plant magnetoreception, the research into can plants sustain themselves, not just in soils, but in a different strength of magnetic field. And so some foraging insects actually see not only the magnetic field, fish, the zebra fish, for example, they actually see the Earth's magnetic field and the interaction with the ultraviolet. So no human's ever seen that kind of stuff. So who sees correctly? And again, no one sees correctly. We just see the limits of our perceptual abilities. And so I think it's absolutely fascinating. And coming back to what you said about even psychic auras, a neuroscientist called Vilayanur Ramachandran, it demonstrated that there was an autistic child who his mother thought there must be a way of helping my child to understand people, because he wasn't able to understand or relate to people. So his mum taught him a colour emotion code that if he saw someone smiling, he was to give that a colour. And if he saw someone frowning, he was to give that a colour. If he saw someone with facial expressions of anger, he would give that a colour. And they worked out a code for every facial expression, what that means. And here is the colour. And he was to picture the colour in his mind. And it just allowed him to understand people a bit better, because kids like colours, you know, rather than intellectually saying that means angry. It was easier for the child to picture it. But what was amazing is the brain is so neuroplastic that Ramachandran did a study, and he proved that this child, what happened to the child at a certain age is the colour, and this is what Ramachandran found, the colour processing region called V4 had actually integrated into part of what's called the mirror neuron system that allows us to understand people's facial expression, so that the boy actually physically now saw an aura, an envelope of colour that appeared around anyone whose colour actually reflected the person's emotional state, because the person's emotional state is always reflected in our facial expressions. It's why you smile when you're happy, you frown when you're sad. You know, so what he actually saw was a visual representation of people's states. So he could actually tell you how a person's feeling by the envelope of colour. And as woo-woo as it sounds, Ramachandran started to study it, and he found that this overlap had occurred in the brain. And he said, everyone's brain's capable of that. But it's just such a woo-woo concept that no one's willing to investigate it and see if we could train ourselves. And all it is was training ourselves to perceive something in a way the brain is capable of doing, but we've just not trained ourselves to do that because it sounds too woo-woo and out there. But he said it might actually help children on the autism spectrum to better understand their world and better learn to interact, because it gives them a way of perceiving in a way that's more friendly to them.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely makes a lot of sense to me. And I think on that sort of note of training one's brain, after listening to the book and just sort of analyzing my own behaviors, you know, walking around London, it's an urbanized environment. You almost feel like not negative energy, but sort of sometimes abrasive energy to other people. And what I've been trying to do is practice a lot more sort of metta, like, you know, loving kindness and trying to spread that just in my mind, not literally going up to people and saying, I love you, like have a great day, but just in my mind and conjuring up sort of hero stories about other people. And I, you know, as I practice it, even after 24 hours, you know, I just felt a lot better on myself, and I'm training my brain to sort of be a lot more pleasant and create my own sort of positive mental environment. I wonder what you practice every day, given that, you know, you've been in this for so long and, you know, you've written a book on kindness. What are sort of like your tools in your toolbox when it comes to practicing this self-care yourself on a daily basis?
Exactly that, metta. I do exactly the same as you. You know, I do metta meditation every day. You know, I think of people, may you be happy and well and safe, and may you feel at ease. But I also do that in the street. Not every day, not all the time. But if I'm aware that my state isn't how I'd like it to be, then my go-to in my mind is metta. You know, may you be happy. And I even see people looking stressed or upset or in a hurry, and I say, may you be happy in my mind and well and safe, and may you feel at ease. And what happens, in fact, here's a reason why you can feel a bit kind of negative around negative people. It's called the emotional contagion, you know, and your brain, you have a mirror neuron system in the brain. It's cells in the brain that mirror people's facial expressions. So because people's facial expressions and body language betrays how they feel. It's called the emotional contagion, how we catch it. Because your mirror neuron system mirrors the expressions you see in people's faces. So if you walk by 25 people and 20 of them have angry faces, then the chances are, by the time you get to the end of those 25 people, your mirror neuron system's distorted your facial expressions and you'll be frowning. Now, there's a correlation now between your facial expression and your brain chemistry, and very quickly you will start to feel angry as well. You won't understand why you feel angry, but in large part, it comes down to the mirror neuron. It's not the only reason why this happens. There is some more subtle things, but mostly it's the mirror neuron system. So what you do with your metta, and what I do, is when you change your state, may you be happy, well, and safe, you're no longer catching it from someone else. But what you start becoming is a projector, and you start projecting, and their mirror neuron system will catch how you feel. And the more people you pass through 20 by 25 people, at least some of those 25 people will capture and won't understand why, but they'll come away with a smile on their face. They won't understand why. And that smile on their face will actually change the thoughts that they're thinking, because there's always a correlation between facial expressions and how you feel, your outer state and your inner state. And you actually affect people without realizing by doing metta. And it's partly how kindness is contagious. I do exactly the same thing on purpose because I know that's how it works. But my self-care as well is I'm aware of how I feel, and I try to take steps to do things in my life that improve my state. And some of that for me is finding things in my life that have meaning and purpose and do more of them. Even if it means that I'm really, really busy, I don't have time to do that. But if I'm really, really busy and I choose the busyness over the things always that make me feel good, then I'll be less effective at doing the things that I'm doing. But if I can make the time for things, I play tennis most days. I live in Dunblane. It's kind of expected, the home of Andy and Jamie Murray. But I get a lot of enjoyment out of that. And playing it against other people in the leagues gives meaning. It's meaningful for me. And even though it takes time away from a busy working day, because I'm feeling better, that positive feeling state I have enhances everything that I do. And there's lots of research that actually shows that exact thing. Do more of what makes you feel good on the inside, and you'll find you'll be much more effective in everything you do on the outside as well. So, but I'm glad you mentioned Meta, because that's exactly what I do as well. I do it as a practice in the house, but I also do it out in the street if I feel I have to.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. I'm definitely a fan, and I'm a massive fan of you. I love the book. I love your energy. I'm in awe of the number of books that you've published as well. It's incredible.
Well, I'm a fan of you. I use your cookbooks.
Brilliant. I love it. David, this is brilliant. Look, we're not going to do any more podcasts until we can actually do it in person, because I feel like I'm missing out on the energy of being in person, even though I know after reading your book that it can exist universally as well. So yeah, no, I really appreciate you taking the time, and I can't wait to do this again at some point in the future.
My pleasure. It's been an absolute pleasure again, so thanks very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed myself.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. You can find all this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com. Remember, you can watch this on YouTube, and you can sign up for the Eat, Listen, Read newsletter. Go check it out on thedoctorskitchen.com/newsletter. I'll see you here next time.